Okay. What is it? What is it? The 12th? Oh, 5th. Oh, yeah, okay.
You are getting ahead
of here. Okay, yeah. All right, December 5. And so I've decided that the title of this particular session will be The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh.
And that is because, thank you.
Trust you must.
Yeah, right.
Get this out of here.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's great.
That's the best of the Star Wars movies, by the way.
Yeah, that's what my older son, Brian, says. He's a fanatic, Star Wars fanatic. And yeah, he says The Empire Strikes Back is the best of the three.
Right, the best of the nine.
Well, yeah, but, yeah. So, yes, so it's The Empire Strikes Back this morning because you're going to learn, hey, John,
thanks.
Why William James says Don Ross doesn't know what he's talking about.
We've always said that.
I'll remember that.
I see your question is right.
Join me on the dark side, Don.
Yeah. But so I thought I would, though, start with Tom's question of last time, because it in fact, will lead into what we're going to talk about. See, what we're going to talk about today. We finished talking about pragmatism, the series of lectures titled Pragmatism. And the next thing we're going to talk about is the meaning of truth, and the subtitle of the meaning of truth is A Sequel to Pragmatism. So, obviously, this is the next thing on the list, right? And that sequel to pragmatism is really a hodgepodge of stuff. It's it includes some occasional pieces he wrote, some essays published in various journals. It's really a collection of and a rather disorganized collection of just stuff. I would say it has two themes. One theme, which is the one I'm going to talk about today, or first at least, is a defense. A defense of pragmatism. I was explaining to people why the title of today's class is The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh.
actually, you weren't here last week, but I was... Well, I guess it's pretty obvious I've been critiquing William James fairly severely as we've been going along, and I've been talking about how vague these various formulations of the pragmatic method are. In the meaning of truth, he is dealing with two broad issues, and the first one that we're going to talk about, because it relates to where we are right now, is a defense of pragmatism against objections. And of course, as you know, we've been objecting right and left here, but probably most of our objections kind of have been going in the same direction. Anyway, as I say, it's a collection of various essays and whatever. I have reduced his replies to the objections to five objections with five replies, and that encompasses a fair amount of material that is very repetitive. The other theme in the meaning of truth is the so-called humanism of FS, is it FSC or whatever his first name? It's not FSC, is it? It's FCS, sorry. FCS Schiller. And I've mentioned him occasionally. And it's not a name on everybody's lips, certainly. And of course, if you look up in an encyclopedia or something and look under pragmatism, I'm sure what you'll see is, you know, Peirce, James, and Dewey, the three American pragmatists. But F.C.S. Schiller was he was born in Germany, but he migrated to England, and so he was a British pragmatist, really, he had a view that was very similar to that of William James, but he called it humanism. And so the other half of the book, of the meaning of truth, is concerned with basically distinguishing between James's version of pragmatism and Schiller's humanism. You'll appreciate this, Reuben. Today it's The Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
But anyway, so I'm going to start, though, with Tom. And because the objection that Tom raised last time is, you know, pretty much along the same lines as all of us, I think, have been a little bit uncomfortable with the way James has been formulating things. So what we're going to try to do in this second work of his that we're going to be entering is to see if we can maybe defend James a little bit better and get a little richer understanding of what's going on with pragmatism. I'm a firm believer in... Marty, I don't know if you've read yet my first summary of the Kant class Friday, but in it, I alluded to a professor of mine, not my main professor, but I took at least one class from him, maybe two or one and a half, and that was Paul Ricoeur, a French guy, who had a joint appointment at the Sorbonne, I think, and he always used to, he was a good guy. He always used to laugh that the term that he spent at Chicago was the winter term. And he says, why did I do that? You know, why didn't I do the fall term? Because the falls are beautiful out in the Midwest. Why didn't I do the fall term in the Chicago and then go back to the Sorbonne during the winter? But no, it was the other way around, you know. But anyway, he was, of course, a continental thinker, and a lot of continental philosophy in the 20th century centers around the idea of hermeneutics, and that is, how do you interpret a text? And Ricoeur made a really useful distinction, which I allude, well, I do more than allude to in that summary I sent out yesterday, between a hermeneutic of sympathy and a hermeneutic of suspicion. The reason that's near and dear to my heart is that the hermeneutic of sympathy is the practice of Aristotle, I would say, when dealing with another thinker, to his eternal credit. He, Aristotle, uses what we sometimes call the principle of charity. In other words, how can I construe what this person said in the best possible light? You know, what is it about this person's, for example, Socrates says that all virtues are one, something like that, you know, one of the things he says. And so Aristotle asks the question, okay, well, how can I possibly construe what Socrates may have been thinking about in order to say that, so that, hey, you know, what a concept, maybe we can learn something, right? And then maybe we can see that he was onto something, but maybe there was a flaw in there too, so we can clarify how he was right and maybe where he went astray. But at least you have to start with the default assumption that somebody has captured some part of the truth. But anyway, my only point is that a responsible way of approaching any philosopher is to exercise the hermeneutic of sympathy, aka the principle of charity, and trying to understand put this person's ideas in the best possible light. Therefore, what I'm going to do is respond to Tom's criticism, which is pretty much, I think, maybe what some of us have been thinking all along. And this was in the context of my example that I've been using repeatedly of the Copernican versus the Ptolemaic theory of the, you know, where is the center of the universe, and the earth or the sun. I mean, that was what the issue was. They had no concept of the solar system back then. It was just the universe. So I was envisioning last time an example, say a case of suppose you have somebody around the time of Galileo, say first half of the 17th century, and this person is very much committed to the Ptolemaic view, and finds this view meaningful and theologically significant, because it puts us at the center of everything, and God is out there outside space and time. But when God looks in space and time, as it were, quote unquote, looks, you know, what's right, the bullseye, it's you and me. And it gives me a feeling of being at home in the universe. It affects my everyday life, because I have a confidence that things are going to turn out all right because of the theological links with my Earth-centered worldview. So in other words, it has practical consequence. That's my point in adding that little detail. It has practical consequences. But also, I understand, because I'm a 17th, this is a oxymoron, I'm a 17th century pragmatist. So I understand that that there is this observation, there's another pragmatic consequence, which has to do with observation. And so there are observational consequences of the Ptolemaic system versus the Copernican system. Namely, as I said many times, the Ptolemaic system will predict that there are no phases of Venus, because since Venus is always close to the sun in the Ptolemaic system, Ptolemy had to make sure that here's the Earth and the sun's going around the Earth, and that Venus wasn't ever very, very far from wherever the sun was. So you'd never have a case of where the Earth is here, the sun is here, and Venus is here at right angles, so you'd have a half Venus or a whole or a full Venus when it's almost behind the sun, that sort of thing. So it's indeed is an experimentum crucis, this idea that that indeed that should decide between the two worldviews, right? And sure enough, of course, Galileo trains his telescope on Venus, and what does he find? He finds phases in Venus. You know, you can't detect it with the naked eye, of course, because Venus is so bright. It's sort of, you know, any version of Venus is going to just be really, really bright, and it's going to wash out any fine detail. But you train a telescope on it, and you can see a half Venus or a full Venus or a quarter Venus or whatever. So here I am, a pragmatist of the 17th century, and I understand all the ramifications. So here's my assessment of the situation, because I'm a pragmatist. The evidence is mixed. The evidence is mixed. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, we have all these theological connections with the idea of an Earth-centered universe. And it has a practical effect on my life and all of that sort of thing. And that's one bit of evidence. And there's another bit of evidence having to do with the phases of Venus, right? So the evidence is mixed. Now let me, before I pronounce anything, I'm just telling the story up to that point. Let me tell another story and link it with, say, current issues. Climate change, say. Well, you know, anything like climate change is a complicated phenomenon, to put it mildly, right? Climate change is a complicated phenomenon. And I'm just making stuff up here, so I don't know if any of this is remotely true, but let's just pretend that it is. Suppose we observe, because we have many, many weather stations worldwide, we do observe that the average temperature of many, many places on Earth is, oh, say, whatever, you know, half a degree warmer now than it was 20 years ago, say. I don't know. But suppose, for example, around Antarctica. Suppose in Antarctica there's been more snow than usual, and it's been colder than usual, okay? So we say the evidence is mixed, right? I mean, you go to Alaska or Siberia or something, you find the permafrost melting. You go to Antarctica, in my scenario, and it's colder than normal, right? The evidence is mixed. Now, what do we do? Well, being rational beings, we say, okay, well, we need to look for the the balance of the evidence, right? I mean, nothing as complicated as climate change. I'm sorry, nothing as complicated as climate change is going to have 100% of the evidence pointing in one direction. It's always going to be, you have to make an assessment. But if the balance of the evidence, say, is pointing toward a warmer Earth, then there's this anomaly, say, around Antarctica. But that's life. I mean, that's what happens. And you can come up with your own story. I mean, I just came up with this off the top of my head yesterday. But if you want to come up with a different story, that's fine. But we all know that in the real world, where we're dealing with complex phenomena, it's very possible that the evidence is mixed, and we simply obviously assess the data, and wherever the balance of the evidence points, then we tentatively, or depending on the degree of balance, but with a greater or lesser degree of confidence, lean on that side, right? And so we might say, well, yeah, I get it. You know, Thomas S. Kuhn, for example, in his book on the nature of scientific revolutions, he talks about anomalies. And, you know, even in the mathematical or physics, applied mathematics, even in those cases where you think if anything is absolutely clear and stacked in one way and not, even then there are observations that are anomalous, you know. And Kuhn's idea, of course, in the structure of scientific revolutions is, well, the anomalies start accumulating and for a time, we can ignore them or explain them away, but eventually they mount up, and then the whole business comes crashing down, and you have a scientific revolution, and you have to have a new paradigm, and the whole deal. I'm not going to get into that detail, but I'm only saying that because he insists that even in the hard sciences, you know, you're going to have anomalies of kind or another. So it's never just 100%, but. You know, we have to be judicious in how we assess the data. Anyway, so why is this relevant? Well, okay, so let me continue the story about Antarctica a little bit more. So, first of all, there are two possibilities here. At one point, we might just say, okay, I get it. I do see there's this anomaly down there in Antarctica. It doesn't fit with what seems to be going on everywhere else in the world. But because there are just so many places everywhere else that seem to indicate that the Earth is getting warmer, I guess we just have to live with this anomaly down in Antarctica, you know? That's one possibility. Another possibility, and an even better possibility, of course, is, well, we look into this Antarctic situation a little further, and lo and behold, we discover that we can explain why it's the anomaly given the characteristics of weather in a warmer Earth, given the configuration of the Earth, planet Earth, maybe something about the prevailing winds around Antarctica or something isolates it, or, you know, whatever. You know, you can make up your own story. But in other words, that second possibility is, well, yes, it was an anomaly, but now we figured out why it was a special case. And so we basically absorbed the anomaly into the overarching theory, which is even better. Then we don't have that tension where we have this anomaly out there and we don't know what to do with it, right? See what I mean? All right, now let's go back to the case of the Copernican versus the Ptolemaic worldview. So we have this 17th century pragmatist, and it's just like the climate change problem, right? You got conflicting data because this guy's a pragmatist, and he's including not just the observations of Galileo, but also his theological, the pragmatic effects from these theological connections and whatnot. So this person says, yeah, it's just like that climate change thing. He looks in his crystal ball and sees, you know, and some of the data point to an Earth-centered universe, some of the data point to a Sun-centered universe. Now, being a rational pragmatist, which should I take? Yeah? My point is, because you were implying last time, I think, and in my answer, I think, sort of implied what I'm saying now, but I surely didn't flesh it out. William James is not saying that, oh, just because I like this theory and it's meaningful to me, it makes me feel at home in the universe or whatever it is, that I'm gonna believe that, forget about, you know, the phases of Venus or anything like that, because I just like it. I'm going to believe because I like it, because it's a pragmatic consequence and makes me feel warm and fuzzy, so I'm going to believe it for that reason. James is not saying that, right? He is saying that the warmth and fuzziness of it is just one of the other pieces of data that you have to weigh against other items as well, right? So just like in the case of Antarctica being the outlier and the rest of the world being the way it is, and we have to balance the two, this rational pragmatism of the 17th century also has a similar observation. We have the data are mixed, you know. Some of the data indicate the phases of Venus part indicates that the sun is at the center of the universe, but my theology tells me the earth is at the center of the universe. So how do I assess it? Right? Okay, two possibilities for a purely rational person of the age of Galileo. Just like the Antarctica thing, two possibilities. One possibility. Well, I guess Copernicus was right. And this other is just an anomaly. I don't know what to do about it. It just doesn't fit in this angst, you know, because that's my whole warmth and fuzziness, right? That's my whole feeling of at home in the universe. I don't know what to do about it, but I get it. I do understand that the visual evidence is better evidence than my theological evidence, say. That's one possibility. And that's like the one where I say, well, yeah, global warming is a reality and the Antarctica case is an outlier. It's just life and we have to accept it. You know? But remember, there was another one where we said, but if we pursue it further, we can now maybe explain why that's really not an anomaly after all, because of the further characteristics of the area of the Earth around Antarctica, whatever it was, and now we absorb what was an anomaly into the overarching theory, right? Well, this guy back in the 17th century is in a similar situation. So the first possibility is, yeah, Copernicus is right. Galileo proved it. I don't know what to do with this anomaly over here. But then he thinks a little bit more about it. And by the way, Kuhn talks about this. You know, he was talking about how bad the church looked back in the, you know, but doing the house arrest business with Galileo, the whole deal, how bad that looked. And he makes the point. He says, well, you know, these theological problems, they can be worked out. It just takes a while. And so our rational pragmatist of the 17th century then might be somebody of the ability of Thomas Aquinas, maybe, or somebody like that, who faced the same problem, by the way, and then rework and deepen that person's theology. Just as when we are able to bring the Antarctica so-called anomaly into the fold of the dominant theory, and it no longer is an anomaly, here too, the theological connections with Ptolemaicism, which looked like an anomaly at first, I realized, well, maybe in order for God to be a loving God and to be concerned with creation, maybe we don't have to be in the center, you know? Maybe God's purview is so immense that God really cares about the little obscure corners of this immense universe that we're in. So maybe I've learned something about God in the process. Maybe I've deepened my theology now by bringing in and making it no longer an anomaly anymore and bringing it into the fold of what now is the dominant viewpoint, which would be the Copernican viewpoint. You see what I mean? You see what I mean?
He also knew where to stop and not speculating on whether there were little people on other parts of the universe, too.
Well, of course, that's a, you know,
he
maybe.
He knew where to draw the fence.
I know, well, maybe. But, yes. Oh, were you going to say something, Bonnie?
Could you please repeat the question?
That's it's not important.
Oh, he was just saying.
Can you repeat it? 'Cause I can't.
No, I get it. Yeah, Tom was just saying that also might bring along the idea that there is intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, et cetera, et cetera. And you're absolutely right.
But he knew what he could probably get away with to some degree.
Who's he?
Thomas Aquinas.
Oh, Aquinas. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're talking about him. Oh, good.
Yeah, your example where he his theology took another perspective.
I know. You know, that's the
but
thing.
But he didn't keep going.
What do you mean he didn't keep going?
Into other extensions of what that means.
Well, you know what? Well, let me just tell you what I was thinking this morning. If Aquinas could have been reincarnated in the middle of the 17th century, and then witnessed the reaction of the church. Mm-hmm. To this scientific revolution, I bet you my bottom dollar he would have said, what do you guys think you're doing? You know, look, in my day, mm-hmm. in the 13th century, I had to confront the same problem. We had this new science on our hands, i.e. the science of Aristotle, and that was the best that we had at the time. It didn't necessarily in all points agree with Christian theology, but look, what do you have to do? You got to do a little work. That's what you have to do, and that's what I did. I wrote the Summa Theologica to show how we can integrate Aristotelian science and Augustinian theology. Why can't you guys do the same thing? You lazy or something? You know. So yeah, there was no Thomas Aquinas, alas, in the middle of the 17th century. I don't know if that's what you were saying, but that's what I was thinking this morning. But anyway, back to William James, of course. So James is not saying, oh, if I just happen to like it, that's going to override any sort of rational consideration. He's not saying that. What he is saying is this, and I'm going to take a chance here and draw something on this board. We spent, what, 20 minutes?
Oh, erasing it.
This board erased. Yeah. This one over here was not so bad. Sally, all single-handedly did that half of it without that much trouble, but then she spent the rest of her time doing that.
Trying.
So we're all sort of exhausted. We all have to go back home. Yeah. Well, anyway. So here's my circle again. Okay? I'm going to label this humankind.
While you do that, tell me what your original question was that started this.
Well, my point was that, in another way, was that if you're going to challenge the church with his, like, that logical argument, mm-hmm. in his case, or very others, they knew how far they could push it and not necessarily continue their thinking to the next level or the level beyond it, where they might get in real trouble.
Well, you're talking about the 17th century?
Well,
or the
at any point. When you're challenging...
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
I mean, at various points in history, you know...
Right.
You know, either they didn't want to publish it or they didn't even want to think about
it. I know.
So that's what I was...
That's a practical. That's a practical consideration. In this class, we're not concerned with practical matters. I have to tell you that John... and Riley, and maybe a few other people, are the people I rely on for practical kinds of things. I handle all the theory, but you know, when it comes to anything practical, I'll ask John or I'll ask Riley or somebody like that. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I have a question for you, John. Has to do with traffic lanes, and when you're approaching Oakmont from the north. You got this bicycle lane over here. And suppose you want to turn right on Oakmont. Which lane should you be turning from? Are you supposed to get over into the bicycle lane at the last minute and turn from there because that's the rightmost lane? Or are you supposed to turn from the middle lane?
You look.
From which lane?
Huh? You look and see if there's anybody in the bike lane.
Well, of course. Yeah. But do you turn from the right lane?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, okay. I got my answer. All right, so this is humankind. This represents the bounds of knowledge, right? And, of course, the really interesting question is, well, what's outside the bounds of knowledge? For Hume and Kant, another one of Tom's questions way on back, ethics was not outside the bounds. That was inside. But theology, for example, would be outside the bounds of knowledge. Okay. Okay, now you go a little later in history. You go to the 1930s. I'm going to draw another circle. And you know what this is going to look like. All right? Now these are the logical positivists. All right? They drew the circle really tight. The meaning of the statement is a method of verification. And there are two possible ways of verifying a proposition. Either it's analytic and a priori, or it's synthetic and a posteriori. But ethics is about values, it's not about facts. So ethics, aesthetics, they're outside here. And of course, once again, theology, of course, is way outside. That stays outside. But you see, there's a difference there. So the logical positivists draw their circle really, really tight, and there's quite a bit of stuff then that is unverifiable and therefore just utter nonsense. We ought to just leave it aside, forget it, and not even worry about it. Whereas for Hume and Kant, who are actually the originators of positivism, they have a more generous criterion, let's
say. Would it be fair to say the positivists are wholly contained within the bigger circle?
I don't understand what you mean.
Everything the logical positives, from a Venn diagram perspective, they would be inside the...
Yeah. If I were to draw this over here, they'd be somewhere inside here.
Something missing.
That's my intent. Maybe I should have drawn it. Maybe I should have done it.
That's okay.
But anyway, my third circle is going to be William James. In fact, it's such a big circle, you wonder if there's anything outside of it. Because it definitely will include theology, includes religion. You see what I mean then? If I had drawn, maybe I should have drawn it differently for Tom's sake. You know, put the logical positivists in here and then drawn it around this one, something, because everything in Hume and Kant is going to be in James, of course, too. So, yes.
Well, not necessarily, because they could argue about, like art aesthetics.
Well, I think as a matter of historical fact, okay, everything that would be accepted by Hume and Kant would be accepted by William James. You know. So, this being the Empire Strikes Back, I'm going to read you from the first of the objections that William James treats. If I can find which little tab refers to that one. As I say, this book, The Meaning of Truth, is so it's a collection of stuff, and the same thing. It's very repetitive. The same things come up over and over because he's examining. What did Bertrand Russell say? And what did this other person say? And what did this other person say? And a lot of time, what they say overlaps a great deal. But anyway, very first objection, though, this particular chapter titled "The Pragmatic Account of Truth and Its Misunderstanders, he goes over eight objections there, and a lot of those overlap too. As I say, I've reduced the whole book to just five objections and answers. But objection number one, and this is pertinent to what we've just been talking about, objection number one: first misunderstanding, James says. Pragmatism is only a re-editing of positivism. Take that, Don Ross. You were saying that, you spent how many weeks now talking about the history of positivism and then Peirce and then James and the whole deal, as though this is a sort of a continuous development, and you know, James's pragmatism is a descendant, you might say, of the positivistic approach. And so, first misunderstanding, pragmatism is only a re-editing of positivism. This seems, he says, the commonest mistake. Oh, shame on me. But anyway, this is what he goes on to say. Skepticism, positivism, and agnosticism agree with ordinary dogmatic rationalism in proposing that everybody knows what the word truth means without further explanation. But the former doctrines then either suggest or declare that real truth, absolute truth, is inaccessible to us, that we, of course, that would be everything outside the circle, right? For example. Let's see, where am I? And that we must fain put up with relative or phenomenal truth as the as its next best substitute. By skepticism, this is treated as an unsatisfactory state of affairs, while positivism and agnosticism are cheerful about it, call real truth sour grapes, and consider phenomenal truth quite sufficient for all our practical purposes. In point of fact, though, he says, nothing could be further from all this than what pragmatism has to say of truth. Its thesis is an altogether previous one. In other words, what he's claiming, I'm going to reply to his reply in a second, but I mean, he's claiming that all these other epistemologies assume what truth is. They assume an account of truth. Positivism, agnosticism, skepticism assume that the word truth has a certain definition, but they don't investigate it. They don't investigate it. But pragmatism does. It leaves off, it, pragmatism, leaves off where these other theories begin, having contented itself with the word truth's definition. No matter whether any mind extant in the universe possesses truth or not, it asks, what does the notion of truth signify ideally? What kind of things would be true judgments in case they existed? The answer which pragmatism offers is intended to cover the most complete truth that can be conceived of. Absolute truth, if you like, as well as the truth of the most relative and imperfect description. This question of what truth would be like if it did exist belongs obviously to a purely speculative field of inquiry. It is not a theory about any sort of reality or about what sort of knowledge is actually possible. It abstracts from particular terms altogether and defines the nature of a possible relation between the two of them. Okay, so his reply is, well, no, pragmatism isn't like positivism, because positivism assumes what truth is. It doesn't investigate the question, what is the definition of truth, but pragmatism does. Okay, I'm not sure if that's a true statement even, but here's what I would say in reply. I just think, you know, he goes off on a tangent, and I think what he says is kind of irrelevant to the main point. The main point is, if you look at the history, pragmatism is historically part of the evolution. It's a branch. I mean, you know, here's Hume and Kant here, and, you know, then you'll have various branches going off of that trunk. Pragmatism is one of the branches, and it branches, of course, out into Peirce's version and James's version and Schiller's version and Dewey's version and all that sort of thing. But it historically has its roots in positivism. It simply extends the criterion immensely. But, I mean, this is where it came from. So I think to understand pragmatism, you need to see where it came from, and you need to understand what it's doing in the hands of James, at least, is it's basically now incorporating an awful lot more. And he would say, and going back to, you know, Tom's question of last time, he would say that when you're considering the data, you've got just simply to be more generous about it than, okay, can I actually see it, or is it an analytic proposition that I understand because I understand the meanings of the words, as a logical positivist would say. You simply got to be more generous. Yeah, I mean, my general feeling about something and the way it affects my life, those are legitimate concerns. And as a matter of fact, if it was something that was so remote from empirical or scientific verification, those might be the only concerns. And so what's wrong with that? You see what I'm saying? For example, say some theological point that is so distantly removed from any sort of scientific investigation, it may be the only relevant data would be those kinds of things. It just seems right to me. It feels right to me. Or something along those lines. See what I mean? That's why I used the example of the Copernican versus the Ptolemaic thing, where the guy is rationalist of the 17th century. So, what do you think about that? I mean, so it's basically giving you a more generous criterion. And so it is indeed linked to positivism. Well, I got one more minute. I don't know if I can pick up with this next time. But one of the other objections, objection number two, is from a French guy, Marcel Hebert, I guess is how he pronounces it. But basically, he's a French Tom, I guess. I mean, his objection is similar to the one to our main discomfort that we have expressed up to now, I think. And this is how James summarizes Hebert's objection. Mr. Hebert takes it to mean, that is, pragmatism. He takes pragmatism to mean what most people take it to mean. The doctrine, namely, that whatever proves subjectively expedient in the way of our thinking is true. In the absolute and unrestricted sense of the word, whether it corresponds to any objective state of things outside of our thoughts or not. So in other words, if I like it, it's true. Mm-hmm. To heck with the data or the observational data or anything like that. I like it, it's true. Well, that's just not what he's saying. Now, this is what James says in reply. The anti-pragmatist view is that the workings are but evidences of the truth's previous inherent presence in the idea, and that you can wipe the very possibility of them out of existence and still leave the truth of the idea as solid as ever. But surely this is not a counter theory to the truth of 2 hours. It is the renunciation of all articulate theory. It is but a claim to the right to call certain ideas true anyhow. And this is what I meant above by saying that the anti-pragmatists offer us no real alternative, and that our account is literally the only possible theory extant. What meaning, indeed, can an idea's truth have save its power of adapting us either mentally or physically to a reality? How comes it, then, that our critics so uniformly accuse us of subjectivism, of denying the reality's existence? It comes, I think, from the necessary predominance of subjective language in our analysis. However independent and objective realities may be, we can talk about them in framing our accounts of truth only as so many objects believed in. He takes Hebert's objection to be something like, well, the pragmatists are intent on believing something that even if it doesn't even exist, because I like it subjectively. That's not really that's a bit of a misconstrual. I think that the problem is that the misconception is not that something doesn't exist, but something is just not true. But I'm going to insist on believing it because of these subjective, things that I just like it or something like that. And what I've been trying to say, and I think James would go along with it, is that no. The liking or these other subjective criteria are only criteria among other criteria. And what you need to do is you simply have to assess the data. And you may have a case like the Antarctica sort of thing, where you have an anomaly here or you have the data are mixed. But being a rational person, what you have to do is assess the data and adjust your belief according to the balance of the data is what you have to do. The only difference between what James is saying and actually what the most extreme logical positivists were saying is that our definition of what counts as data is broader. That's it. It's simply a broader criterion for what counts as data. Now, think about that over the week and tell me what you think next week, because, that's the heart of it. See? Yeah.
That bike lane is silly.
Really cut.